You ready?
There's so much to talk about in the beginning. I feel like we haven't had one of them spicy intros in a while. When it really gets people's wheels spinning. Well, we can just do it and see what comes out.
Okay.
All right.
Hi, this is Rachel McElroy.
Hello, this is Griffin McElroy.
And this is wonderful.
Honk, honk, get in the No, that's not it. It's going to be like rush hour traffic thing. Like, we're stuck in it too, but, you know, we're hanging in there. We got our car snacks, but I didn't have anything past that. Do you want to try again?
Okay. Hi, this is Rachel McElroy.
Hey, this is Griffin McElroy.
And this is wonderful.
Honk, honk, I'm a goose. The geese are coming this summertime. They're flocking on back to us, aren't they?
Okay.
One more. These have all been dry and definitely not in the show.
Hi, this is Rachel McElroy.
Hey, this is Griffin McElroy.
And this is wonderful.
Honk, honk. Thanks for listening to Wonderful.
A clown podcast.
The clown show where we
honk horns.
Where we talk about what's new in clown technology. And Rachel, I think you're first this week. So tell me all about new clown tech.
Honk, honk. I have a lapel flower.
Oh, cool.
That squirts 30 yards.
That's fun.
Mm-hmm.
I do.
About you, Honk Honk?
Well, Honk Honk, I got new big pants that when they fall down, but I'm all covered up down there.
Ooh.
Because.
So, like underwear?
No, it's sort of like a second pair. It's really just kind of like a pair of khakis that I have under there.
Pants on pants on pants.
No, it stops at the khakis, but now it's just that when the big pants fall down, everybody gets a good laugh, but I am not exposed.
Honk Honk, what about pants on pants on pants?
Get pretty hot.
And suspenders on suspenders on suspenders.
I need you to calm down. I need you to calm. There's a reason why the clowning arts haven't changed much. They don't evolve very quickly. And right now you're being a little bit heretical.
I'm new school, you know?
I know you're new school. What with your big purple nose? And I'm like, what?
Good. My totally straight clown hair.
We fucking found it, babe. That was it.
Honk honk.
Hey, do you have any small wonders?
I do.
Okay.
But I want you to go first.
I'm going to say power outlets. Not like a surge protect. You know what I mean? Like, what is the word? Power strips.
Okay.
Or
okay.
Like little things.
Yeah, no, that's like bonus outlets. I get
it's
it.
Bonus outlets. It's mm-hmm. wild. Mm-hmm. In my office, like I have a lot of fucking clown tech that I got to plug into stuff. And I've got power strip things all over the place. I got one little thing that's like a corner. You can see it. It turns your two things into six things, but it makes them, it gives it three faces kind of so that you can have the big plugs on it.
That's good.
Why does it work? Why aren't there just six fucking outlets there to begin with? I don't know, but these just multiply the electricity, I guess. Mm-hmm. I love it.
That is really good.
Did you have time to come up with something?
I did.
Okay.
And that thing.
Oh, geez, you didn't, did you?
Is bubble baths.
Okay.
I love a bubble bath.
For you or for our toddler son?
I mean, both, honestly, both. I feel like it's a very low-budge way to treat yourself. You know?
Oh, I see, yeah.
Like, when I do it, I feel like, ooh, this is decadent.
Well, it's unless you use gold leaf bubbles like I do. And boy, let me tell you. That sucks to get off your body at the end
of
it.
Well, yeah, and clogs your drain, I imagine.
And your pores.
Mm-hmm.
Real bad. Gold leaf, don't breathe. Mm-hmm. No, I'm saying it's imperative that you don't breathe while you're in the... Yeah, if you get some of this stuff in your lungs, you're a Bond villain at that point.
Okay.
Do you want to go first? I'm not asking.
It is my turn.
You are prescribed to go first this week.
It is my turn to go first.
What's your first thing, my love?
Crossword puzzles.
Crossword puzzles... are so good.
They're wonderful.
They're so nice. They're little noodle scooters, and you take a while to figure them out, and then when you crack that one clue, mm-hmm. that was Pierce Brosnan. 11 across was Pierce Brosnan.
Pierce Brosnan. Oh, and I misspelled Pierce. That's why.
Oh, that's why it didn't work.
Sometimes I worry with Wonderful that we have gotten too narrow onto our favorite thing. And I will say crossword puzzles aren't my favorite thing.
I fucking hate crossword puzzles.
But they are wonderful.
I recognize they're good even though I despise them.
You can't argue it. And the reason I thought of them recently is I had some like word of the day thing. I was on some site that listed some word of the day. And the word of the day they listed was cruciverbalist.
Oh, that's, what is that?
It's somebody who creates crossword puzzles.
No, and they got to come up with that themselves, I bet.
Probably, yes.
That's a kind of jaggy.
But isn't that wonderful?
It's nice. It's a great word, mm-hmm. but they got to pick it. It's like you can't pick your own nickname, you know?
Yeah. I still like it.
Okay, I like it too.
You know me, I'm all Bodie McBoat-faced over here.
Yeah. During summer, no class.
I enjoy clever for clever's sake.
Sure. Bodie McBoat-faced, man, that's some real...
That's my bar.
Some erudite wit right there.
So crossword puzzles started in 1913.
Really? It took us that long to crack that.
So what's tricky about crossword puzzles is that is a word puzzle a crossword puzzle? And that's kind of where the debate started, is that there's stuff in the 1800s
right.
that was like word puzzles, but was it similar to a crossword puzzle the way we know it today? No.
I mean, it's a Venn diagram, right? Because mm-hmm. word puzzle would include the jumble. And boy, I loved me the jumble. Did your paper have the jumble?
Did I what the jumble?
Did your paper have the jumble?
Of course it did.
Okay.
Did you think that was like an exclusive to Huntington, West Virginia?
I thought Mr. Dispatch of the Herald Dispatch.
Thought one paper could have a jumble in the country?
Yeah. Wait a minute. Did your paper have Family Circus too?
Yes, it did.
I thought that was just a guy in Huntington that made that.
No, Bill Keene.
I knew Bill Keene.
Yeah.
Bill Keene.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, his name was Will Keene. Actually, his name was Will Sutherland. But you could see how I got there.
Yeah, no, I can. The reason 1913 wins generally is that Liverpool, England published a, quote, word cross puzzle.
So close.
Mm-hmm. And then crossword puzzles appeared in the first book published, 1924. I should say that a different way because that was a confusing way to say
sure
it.
Sure was.
So the first book of crossword puzzles appeared in 1924.
Okay.
This was a book apparently that came with a pencil attached to it.
That's
which I
fucking
find
sick. I like that a lot. That's like the like kids' activity books that you'll buy at like rest stations on the highway.
Yeah.
When this book came out, was it a thing for the crossword puzzles to be in the newspaper?
Yes, but the New York Times crossword puzzle, as we know it today, did not exist yet.
Okay. I guess I was asking like, did crossword puzzles,
yes.
did they become popularized because they were a thing that they printed in the newspaper?
Yes.
Okay. So it was not like a thing you sought out, like I'm going to go to the game store and buy some crossword puzzles.
No.
Okay.
No. So this is what was funny is that people, much in the way that people are resistant to new media, they were resistant to crossword puzzles because they felt like it was a waste of time.
Interesting.
So there's all this stuff from the New York Times before they had a puzzle themselves. So for example, in 1924, they said that crossword puzzles were, quote, a sinful waste in the utterly futile finding of words, the letters of which will will fit into a prearranged pattern. This is not a game at all, and it can hardly be called a sport. Solvers get nothing out of it.
Well, this isn't football.
Solvers get nothing out of it except a primitive form of mental exercise, and success or failure in any given attempt is equally irrelevant to mental development.
Well, that's not cricket. It's words. That's not a sport. Get that out of here.
I find it so interesting that, and I guess it was the time period, but this idea that it was fun was not enough. Like that it was wasteful and not productive
right.
was like outrageous.
My history knowledge is, as I think we've covered on this show many times before, a garbage disposal.
Mm-hmm.
And so you'll forgive me if this is an unfair evaluation, but I just feel like 1909 through like 1950, things were tough.
Yeah.
You had to kind of grit your teeth to get stuff done.
That's true.
So I think it's that mindset of just like, we just finished one world war. I know that second one's around the corner. Don't fill these little squares up with letters, folks. I need you to buy war bonds instead.
So the New York Times kind of continued on its anti-crossword streak in 1925. They said the craze evidently is dying out fast, and in a few months it will be forgotten.
Kind of a self-dunk there.
And then in 1929, said the crossword puzzle, it seems, has gone the way of all fads. Suggesting that it was like
shit.
On the way out. But then all of a sudden, 1942, they have their own crossword puzzle. And that's like the one. The New York Times crossword puzzle is like the gold standard.
The big one.
Yeah.
In 1950, did they run one about like how print media was dead?
Probably.
Okay.
So have you heard of Will Shorts?
Yes.
I don't know if his name is pronounced Shorts or Shores. but it's spelled Shorts.
Is he the one who makes the crossword puzzle for the New York Times?
Yes.
I don't know how to pronounce his name, but I have heard of him.
So he's a super interesting guy, as I found out from researching him. So I
he's 12
about
feet
him.
Tall. He eats a whole can of beans every
Did
morning.
Did you ever see the 2006 documentary Wordplay?
No.
It was all about like the crossword puzzle championships. And there were like interviews with people that were crossword puzzle enthusiasts. And they also featured Will Shorts.
I don't think I saw this one.
Okay. So I didn't know much about him other than he had crossword puzzles. But apparently he was born and raised on an Arabian horse farm in Indiana.
Those are good horses, folks.
Mm-hmm. He graduated from Indiana University and is the only person known to hold a college degree in enigmatology, which is the study of puzzles.
How is that? How can there be one person that holds a degree? How does that work?
So
somebody had to teach him, right? No?
So Indiana has a individualized major program where you can design your own curriculum.
What?
Mm-hmm.
So I could go there and like major in potions?
Potentially, yeah.
Fuck yeah. This is the last episode of this podcast.
He also got a law degree, but never took the bar. He's been the crossword puzzle editor for New York Times since 1993. He founded and directed the crossword puzzle tournament and founded the World Puzzle Championship in 1992.
Hmm. Interesting.
He's just a big old puzzle guy.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
And he's like the guy now.
Do you think he's who the Riddler's based on?
Oh.
By which I mean, do you think he's tried to kill the Batman? And if so, how many times?
So now I only really do crossword puzzles when I'm on a plane and it's in the back of the in-flight magazine.
Yeah, I for a while there.
But you can find a lot of them online.
Yeah, that's my jam is like iPad apps with crossword puzzles. It's very rare, but I will get on like a crossword puzzle kick. There was a while living in Chicago where I fancied myself a hard copy paperback or paper reader. Mm-hmm. I just sit on the porch in the fall and just read my paper and drink my coffee and
mm-hmm. Like a real newsman.
Like a real hardened newsman, but mm-hmm. really I was just trying to get to that crossword, which I would probably give up on in about 20 minutes if I didn't manage to just pound straight through it. Fuck Sudoku though, right?
Oh God.
It's just
I was into it for a little bit and like the great blossoming of Sudoku, but now I just
Has the New York Times ever dragged Sudoku before? Probably. Can I talk about my first thing?
Yes.
So I've been watching a bunch of, or last week was Summer Games Done Quick. I feel bad for not mentioning it. I feel like I try to keep the wonderful audience abreast of the video game speedrunning marathon scene. It was, from what I've watched, pretty rad. They raised over $3 million, which is by far like the most they've ever raised for Doctors Without Borders, which kicks ass. Watching what I watched, though, it inspired me to talk about another game franchise that is called Zelda. It's called Zelda is in the title most of the time. Most of the time, it's about Zelda. You were a Sega household, and I feel like one of these days I need to bring like fucking, Vector Man or something, you know, Vector.
I had a friend that had the Nintendo, but we only ever did Mario.
Well, interestingly, like there are a few core Nintendo franchises, right? And you can probably like name them even though you're not big into the scene, like Mario, mm-hmm. Zelda, mm-hmm. The Pink Man Kirby. I know you're a fan. Mm-hmm. I know you're a fan of his work. Mm-hmm. Maybe I should bring the Pink Man Kirby to the show at some point.
Well, I mean, my knowledge of Kirby is just that he is a pink man.
And he likes to eat.
It's not like I could really participate in a spirited conversation.
That's fair. What's interesting is that Zelda and Mario were being developed actually at the same time. There's a lot about Zelda's history that I didn't really quite appreciate, even though I have a tattoo of the thing on my left wrist. I also feel a little bit basic talking about this because I feel like Zelda is the gaming equivalent of pizza. Like, of course, it's very good. And most people really like it. But I think that position kind of takes for granted what a transformative game it was when it first came out. If you've never played one before, there's been like nearly 20 of them across the different like gaming console generations. And they, you know, usually all have recurring themes where you're this hero of time named Link and you got to collect some MacGuffins. Until you have to collect the Triforce, which is like the big MacGuffin.
MacGuffin?
A MacGuffin is like a object that you need in order to finish your quest. It's the thing that moves the plot along, right?
Oh, okay.
So in Zelda, the MacGuffin is the Triforce most of the time. You got to collect the pieces of it and beat Ganon, save Zelda, whatever. And that format has been like really, really static throughout the 33 years that the franchise has been around with like little tweaks on it. But it's always like so exciting to see familiar things, like familiar components. There's a town in nearly every Zelda game called Kakariko Village, and just like playing a new Zelda game for the first time and running across it and being like, oh, I know this place, but it's different in this game is like, in a way, I guess it's cashing in on nostalgia, but there's something that is really refreshing about having that like coherent a world, even though all the games are different and technically take place in like different sort of spots on the very complicated timeline, which I'm not even going to get into. Watch David Brian Gilmer's video that he did for Polygon on it.
Brian David Gilmer.
What did I, we Brian both David said it really.
Gilbert.
David Brian Gorman.
Brian David
Gilman. Brimmon Gibby. And yeah, there's a few components of it that I think make the games really successful. It's like the games are really vibrant and the worlds are very inviting. A lot of the time you spend your time sort of going through these different dungeons, which are usually based around like one kind of core puzzle mechanic or new special tool that you'll find that'll just add something new to the gameplay. And it like squeezes every drop out of every gameplay idea that it introduces, all the way up to these like really great, exciting boss fights that are kind of like a finals, like a hard test for all the studying you just did while going through the dungeon. Like that format is literally they've used hundreds of times now throughout the games, and it's still really exciting each time. So like all this stuff is great. It's why I've like always really loved the games. I can't think of another game franchise that is just consistently as good as this. Like every game that comes out, you can probably count on it being like really, really good. And all that stuff, like the exploration that you do in these games and the polish, the way that everything has been so thoroughly thought out and the way that the world feels, all that stuff, like that was not the norm for video games when this came out in 1986. It was originally, alongside Mario, was supposed to come out for the Famicom Disk System, which was the console that came right before the NES.
Yeah.
And these two games were being designed at the same time, produced by Shigeru Miyamoto, who is like the creator of a lot of like beloved Nintendo franchises. And it was written by Takashi Tezuka, and together they were working on Zelda while Mario Brothers was being designed simultaneously. And what was really neat, and I never really understood, is that these two games were kind of a foil for each other while they were being developed, because Mario is very much about like linear, going to start to, and Mario was revolutionary in a way too, because there weren't that many games that weren't just like score chase arcade games. Mario like compelled you to play until you got to the end of it, which is like in PC gaming a thing that, you know, had been a thing for a while, but in console terms was like kind of unheard of. But Zelda was the opposite. It was not linear. You could go wherever you want and do whatever you want, in sometimes in like whatever order that you wanted. And what is interesting about that is like when early playtesters tried to play Zelda, like they all catastrophically just fucking failed.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Because it's like, well, they would all get lost and like didn't even know like what they were supposed to be doing in the game, because from the very start there's, you know, three different screens you can exit onto and a cave that you can go explore. Like, oh shit. Like,
that's the way I felt about Myst.
Oh my god, Myst. Yeah,
I was like, what am I supposed to be doing right now?
I've played I think most of the Myst games. I don't think I've ever beaten one of them. But that's a great example of like, well, here's an orb that looks like it's got a picture of a boat on it.
I guess I'll go that way.
I'm gonna write down in my real notebook, remember the boat orb, and go back there and check it out. Miyamoto described wanting to make Zelda a special game. There was a quote where he wanted it to be a miniature garden that players can put inside their drawer. That's so good.
Oh, that is really good.
And he used his time like exploring Kyoto as a child, like the wilderness around surrounding Kyoto as a child. He tells this story about how he's just like got lost in the woods one day and kept walking. And one day he just found a lake he didn't know was there. And that feeling of exploration was something that like, could I get that across in a video game? Which, given the limitations of the hardware at the time, like it's kind of incredible that they did manage to do that. Although it required a lot of onboarding for players who, you know, had not heard of Zelda and how to play it. And that game introduced a lot of people to the concept of like talking to other people who are playing the game and forming these info sharing networks, which I wouldn't be surprised if that led to the Nintendo Tips Hotline or whatever it was called that you see in the Wizard movie. But yeah, like it introduced all of these incredible things to, especially to like console gaming, that I think I just kind of took for granted that like it wasn't a thing before, and Zelda was the thing that kind of made it a staple. The name Link and Zelda, I think I knew at some point. Link is referring to the fact that he is a connected part of the world that players use as their interactive role in the game, literally a link into the game, which is wild. Okay. Also, because the game was supposed to be slightly futuristic when they were first designing it, although that got pretty much scrapped out. And Zelda, can you take a guess at where Zelda came from?
I mean, there's Zelda Fitzgerald.
That's right. It's Zelda. It's named after Zelda
Fitzgerald.
That's
kind of the only other Zelda.
It's kind of the only other Zelda. There's a quote where Miyamoto explained, Zelda was the wife of famous novelist F. Scott Fitzgerald. She was a famous and beautiful woman from all accounts, and I liked the sound of her name. So I took the liberty of using it for the very first title. That's slam dunk attribution, I think. I've always loved this series, and 1986 was a year before I was born, so I don't think I had a good grasp of what the gaming landscape was like then, but I don't think I ever really appreciated what a like actual landmark sort of thing it was until I studied for this.
You know, I feel like I've seen people play Zelda, but my only real familiarity came from when you were playing that version on the Wii.
Oh my God.
When you were still living with Justin.
Yeah, I had to play Skyward Sword for a review where I think I had like a 3 or 4 day turnaround.
Yeah.
And I had to do what we in the industry call, and I don't think Rachel likes this term.
I don't.
But I had to poop sock Zelda Skyward Sword. God, that's my. I'm going to change my second wonderful thing to the term poop socking because, you really don't like it.
I really don't. I just can't hear it and not
just
think
don't
about
like
what it,
it
means
because of the visual. Well, can I steal you away?
Yes, please.
Got a Jumbotron here. This one's for Amy and it's from Declan. Dear Amy, thank you for everything you do for me. You are the light of my life. You keep me going, and I treasure the nearly 4 years we have spent together. I love you so, so much, and I hope I can travel to Brisbane to see you soon. See, I tried to put that sort of, authentic stink on it. Gonna go to Brisbane. Zip it.
Oh, how fun.
He doesn't really do the not the British one. The other Mike Myers does the British, but Brisbane's in Australia, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
I am an unintelligent man.
Can I read this next one?
Did Mike Myers ever play an Australian character?
Not that I know of. That's why you don't know about Australia.
Shit. I haven't seen Love Guru, but I think that's one's more racist.
Can I read the next one?
Sure.
This message is for Elizabeth. It is from Jackie. Hey, Elizabeth, congrats on getting that good master's degree. You're one of the most wonderful people I know, and you're going to be an amazing disaster management specialist. Your pal, Jackie.
An amazing disaster management specialist, I would think, would use their superpowers to stop the, tornado, punch it apart.
Or is the disaster itself amazing?
Oh yeah! Wow, cool tornado. Now
and
I'm going to manage.
Specialize
this way, tornado. This way, away from the people. You're amazing. Listen, tornado. You're beautiful. You're beautiful. You remind me of I don't mean to brag, and I don't like to drop names, but I knew the tornado from the Twister movie, the big one, the main one. I met the cow twister once too. He was kind of a dick. The main one is really cool. Really cool to his fans.
That sounds like a disaster agent, like you are out there promoting your disaster.
I listen to Reading Glasses because Bria and Mallory have great tips.
You're a comics reader and you want to use a library-connected app, you can try out Hoopla.
I listen for the author interviews.
I'm mad at myself that I waited as long as I did to start reading Joan Didion.
They give me reading advice I didn't even know I needed.
If you go in person to an event and go up to an author or a filmmaker or anybody and tell them what you don't like about their work, you're a trash baby.
I understand you didn't like Heroes Season 3. That's fine. I don't actually need to know that information. I'm Bria Grant.
And I'm Mallory O'Mara.
We're Reading Glasses and we solve all your bookish problems every Thursday on Maximum Fun.
What's your second thing?
The frozen summer treat that is Snowballs.
Snowballs, thank God. I thought you were about to talk about the movie Frozen.
The Frozen film.
It's not a good film. It's a good film.
It is a good film.
Fine film. Frozen 2 looks wild.
I really like, I literally didn't see it until like 3 or 4 months ago.
Yeah, Rachel's pretty new to the scene. You rode the Frozen ride before you saw the Frozen movie. That Frozen ride is legit, though.
Oh my God, it's
that
my
shit
favorite.
Makes me at Disney World and Epcot. It makes me cry every time, and I don't know why. Do not have a particularly deep emotional connection to the film, but the ride makes me tear up.
Yeah,
explain that shit, science. You can't. The Imagineers got me.
No, I am talking about the New Orleans confection made with shaved ice and flavored cane sugar syrup.
Have we not talked about tasty flavored ice? It seems familiar to me, but it could just be because we both like it so much that we talk to each other about it without recording.
Well, and here's the thing I want to say right at the top.
Yeah.
I don't like snow cones. I've never been a fan of snow cones. They do nothing for me.
Gross.
A snow cone, the difference between a snow cone and a snowball. So a snow cone is like more of a like a cubed ice, like a crunchy ice.
Right.
And then like a syrup that you pour over the top that inevitably just sinks to the bottom.
Sinks to the bottom.
And they give you a little straw spoon. And usually what you end up doing is just drinking up that syrup and then throwing half the ice away.
Right.
A snow ball is where the ice is shaved so fine that it actually resembles like snow. It's fluffy. It's not coarse and crunchy the way that a snow cone is.
It's a question of how fine you grate that shit. I don't think I ever appreciated the distinction.
So I did a lot of research.
Okay.
The reason I'm talking about this is that Austin is lucky to have a place called Casey's.
I almost don't want you to tell people about Casey's because there's always a line and I love it so much, but a snowball is right on the periphery of like food I will wait 30 minutes for.
Yeah.
Because it is still ice with syrup on it.
They had a sign saying that this was like a New Orleans thing on the side.
Right.
And I thought like, oh, interesting. I'd never really heard of that as a New Orleans thing before. Mm. And then I did some research. It most definitely is.
Yeah, I wouldn't think that they're... So you, before this, you were going to go right up to their booth and say, hey, you're fucking lying. So New Orleans looked at the regular crumbly ice snow cone and said, this sucks. Crunch it up more. Do it again.
So it started in 1933. Ernest Hansen started working on an ice shaving machine. He invented the first motor-driven ice shaving machine. So he kept the machine in the family, and you can still go to Hansen's Snow Blizz in New Orleans. But there are like a dozen other places in New Orleans that do this. Because there was a gentleman that invented his own ice shaving machine. He called the Snow Wizard. And he made it because people had started requesting, you know, that they have a version of it for their own business. And so he started sending them out. You can still buy them, these Snow Wizards. I went online. They're less than $2,000. They are 100 pounds.
Are these antique Snow Wizards? Or are they still making new Snow Wizards?
New Snow Wizards. That's what Casey uses. Casey uses the Snow Wizard.
And they're how much dollars?
$1,974.
That's not much less than $2,000, is it?
No.
We could probably comfortably round that up to $2,000.
It is 100 pounds, though, so I wouldn't necessarily recommend putting it like in your kitchen.
Why not? I got strong countertops.
So they're the primary snowball machines used in Louisiana and like throughout the country where you can find snowballs.
Now, hold on. If I bought one of these $2,000 machines and some of the juice, I can have my own snowball making business.
Yeah. So the Casey's that is here in Austin was actually started by people who were from New Orleans. And it was a kind of a family business. Susie Casey Callagher and Kit Thompson started it in 1996 in Austin. And they just bought a little house that was near an elementary school. And it was at like a four-way stoplight. And they're like, here we go.
That intersection is wild.
Everybody's going to drive past it. Everyone's going to have to stop at the stoplight and see it.
It's one of those broken up intersections. Mm-hmm. And also there's a train track that it crosses. It is wild. But also, you know, the best snowball I've ever tasted is there.
So this is old data. But and when I say old data, it's like from like 2002, an article I found.
Straight up, that was 17 years ago.
At that time, they were consuming anywhere between 16 and 33 blocks of ice a day.
Who was?
Casey's.
Oh, they were selling it.
Yeah.
You said consuming, which made me think that this family was like...
just gnawing on it.
Like Bumbles from the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer sort of universe, just like honking down huge cubes.
They also produce their own chocolate syrup. And so they'll make 10 to 25 gallons of chocolate syrup a day.
Okay, that is impressive.
Yes.
That's quite a bit.
They have 70 different flavors. One of their most popular is Boston Cream Pie, which apparently tastes like a donut.
Yeah.
I am partial to the Mounds Bar, which is like chocolate and coconut. And it's so creamy, you guys. You just don't the even creamy, know.
Let's talk about this creaminess, because I feel like people creaminess. Don't quite understand. When you grate it
it's
down
like
that
ice fine, cream.
It really is like eating ice cream. They also do certain flavor combinations where you can get a scoop of snowball with a scoop of ice cream.
Yes.
They do an orange creamsicle one that is like the tastiest orange syrup in a snowball on a like scoop of vanilla ice cream. Mm-hmm. And it is fucking amazing.
Mm-hmm. And they have all the like wild cherry... Kind of
yeah, they'll let you
typical.
Make your own shit.
Yeah. But yeah, and then the smallest size is just $3. Like, it's not like, I mean, Austin is like kind of known for these super fancy, high-priced restaurants. But Casey's is nice. It's like very unassuming and very affordable.
Yeah.
Like, the most expensive thing on their menu is $6.50.
Yeah, it's too bad it's all gross, so don't go there.
They're open seasonally, though, so they're only open
only
until
in the
October.
Winter. Yeah, December to the end of December. It's weird. I tell them not to do it that way, but they say we don't want people to come here.
I loved it. It changed my life. There were several places in St. Louis when I was growing up that sold snow cones, and I would have friends that were like, "Oh, let's go to the snow cone," and I'd be like, "Oh, okay, cool." And then I'd be like, "I hate this.
Yeah, it sucks.
I'm not enjoying this, and I don't want it." Like 3 minutes in,
yeah,
snowball. Totally
it's way
different
better.
Story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's too bad about all the beehives, though. And the landmines.
Yeah.
It's really too bad. Can I tell you about my second thing?
Yes.
My second thing is a song by LCD Sound System called All My Friends.
Oh.
I love this freaking song, yeah. Man. I love this freaking song. It floored me the first time I heard it. And now, 12 years after it came out, like, it still just knocks me down every time I hear it come on. It is, if you're not familiar, it's a track off LCD Sound System's second album, which is called Sound of Silver, which came out in 2007. And that album is so fucking good. It's like, their first album was self-titled, and it was a just like instant critical, success. It had all of these just like powerful dance jams on it. The most probably well-known of which being Daft Punk is playing at my house.
That was my only exposure to them. And
right.
I went to Lollapalooza, and it was funny because they were on the same day as Daft Punk.
Yeah.
And they were right before Daft Punk. And so it was fun to see them perform that song and then like immediately after have Daft Punk come out.
Yeah. So that first album like kicks ass. And yeah. It was this like great fusion of, all indie rock stuff with also just a lot of really fresh electronic loops and stuff like that. And it was this huge critical success. And so for their follow-up album, like there was some concern that they wouldn't be able to follow it up. But Sounds of Silver sort of evolved on it with like a lot more interesting sounds and sort of weirder hooks for the songs that are on it. And All My Friends is kind of like perfectly emblematic about that. First of all, it's not necessarily a dance jam. It's a song about like aging, which it kind of tackles in a fairly abstract way that makes it kind of more accessible. The frontman for the band, James Murphy, kind of like based the song on his own experience, but you don't have to have lived his life necessarily. I feel like the lyrics are sort of generic isn't a flattering term, but I think maybe it fits where you can kind of find something
universal.
In there. Universal is maybe the word. Thank you. Mm-hmm. About like, especially going over that like late 20s to early 30s hump. And I'm going to play a bit of it now in case you've never heard it before, because it's great. So it's got that piano loop that goes through the whole thing, and it's like this wild, at times seemingly like unsyncopated piano, like clumsy piano loop that somebody's like trying to play live, and maybe they just went with the first take and it wasn't so great. And you hear that when the song starts, you're like, oh shit, like Is this going to be the whole song? Yeah, it's all 7 minutes and 47 seconds of the song. But it's the way that the song builds on it and, you know, builds on every other element that they layer on top of it. Vocals don't even start until a minute 20 in. And so, like, they take their time in sort of building this song over these lyrics that are, like, very, very wistful and evocative, I think. And it builds and builds, but instead of building to like this dance climax, it builds to more of like an emotional climax. And now I've said the word climax too many times in a short span. And I just love it, man. Like, I loved it when I first heard it in college because it was like, I recognized like, oh, this is some of the best music I've ever listened to because I've just come off a streak of only listening to three bands my entire life. But also like, you know, this idea of treasuring your time with your friends and struggling with that as you get older. Like when I was in college, I was like, yeah, man, that's important. And now that I'm 32, it's like, yeah, man, that's important, bud. And I remember my last night that I spent in Chicago, the night before I moved here to Austin, I went with my roommates and some of my buddies to Pitchfork Fest in Chicago. And I saw LCD Sound System. It was my first time seeing them. And they played like everything off Songs of Silver. And when they did All My Friends, like, man, I was just like bouncing up and down with all my friends in Chicago and just like, I cried. Like, I literally cried because I was sad I was leaving all of them tomorrow. And here was a song that could not be more like fitting for that moment. And I don't know, when I hear it, I still get not choked up or whatever, but it still impacts me, I think, in an emotional way that very few songs that I can think of are capable of doing.
I love that. Like, when a song becomes so emblematic of a time in your life and then you can like hear it and be transported back to
instantly.
It
I'm instantly back at the Pitchfork Fest.
Yeah.
And I legitimately think it's one of the best like songs written in my lifetime. And I'm kind of not alone in that because it became sort of the biggest critical hit off of Songs of Silver, which was a Sound of Silver, sorry, that already was like a big successful album. Pitchfork named it the number one song of 2007. And then in 2009, they did a list of the top 500 tracks of the 2000s. And All My Friends was number two. It ranked just below, I believe, B.O.B. by Outkast, which, that's fucking fair. And in the write-up for this, where it got the number two spot, Rob Mitchum wrote, by the end, the piano has become euphoric and confident without changing a lick, a neat thematic trick to accompany Murphy's bittersweet lyrical acceptance of growing old. All My Friends survives the high wire act of growing mature without getting boring, which might just be the lesson Professor Murphy can teach his peers in the next decade. It has received similar sort of praise across the board, and I don't know, that makes me really happy because I would certainly rank it in like top five like best songs I think ever that I've ever heard. It's just a good one, man.
Mm-hmm.
Just a good one. It's tough. That whole album's really good though. Well, speaking of good songs, how about Money Won't Pay by Bowen and Augustus? You can find a link to that in our episode description. What else do we usually do here? I mean, maximum fucking fun, though.
Like, are we going to read listener submissions?
I forget to, don't I? Jesse says, something I find wonderful is cutting vegetables. My Beyonce is the much, and I don't know if that's a flub or if it means fiance, and it says Beyonce, but I like it nonetheless. My Beyonce is the much better cook, so I do all the prep, and I love a good chopping session. There's something so relaxing about chopping tons of vegetables as long as I've got a good sharp knife. And a big, clean cutting board, right? Big, clean cutting board. Gotta get it. Gotta have that mise en place. Mm-hmm. God, I love a good mise en place.
I wish I had thought of that Beyonce line when we were engaged. That's a good one.
I know, but that's 2019 thinking. You know?
It's true.
Don't kick yourself. Laura says, something I find wonderful is taking a shower after swimming or other watery activities. The feeling of a hot shower after being in a cold, damp swimsuit / clothes is just unbeatable.
That's so true. You know what I was thinking of the other day?
What's that?
I love the feeling when you're still kind of in a wet swimsuit and you get in a hot car to like drive away from the pool.
Oh,
that is summertime to me.
Yeah, if you got a towel under your butt, I don't want to ruin. Well, yeah, I don't want to ruin the, you know, I got leather in the Miata. I'm not trying to fuck that up.
I also just kind of like driving in a swimsuit.
Yeah.
It just feels like this is summer, jerks.
Yeah, but I'm not trying to fuck up the Bugatti, you know?
Okay.
Gotta have my liners in there.
Okay.
Rebecca says, the new Sigrid music video is wonderful, not least because when I saw it pop up on my screen, I 100% thought it was Griffin in the starring role. Thank you very much. It's actually the director who stepped in for Sigrid after a series of technical difficulties, and it's a wonderful example of creative people coming together to make something silly and fun. Also, Griffin, you should ask Sigrid to be in her next video. I'll do that. I'll get right on that.
That is a great video. Griffin, you showed that to me not long ago, and I absolutely loved it.
Yeah, I've sort of become a diehard Sigrid stan since Rachel covered that as a segment on the show. It has brought so much joy into my life. That album is fucking great. You know, hey, speaking of great albums, Money Won't Pay by Bowen and Augustus. You can find a link to that in our episode description. Thanks for letting us use that one. And Maximum Freaking Fun. Like, what more can you even say at this point?
Maximum Fun is a great place to find both funny podcasts and narrative podcasts and culture podcasts and music podcasts and
fresh baked breads,
pet podcasts, and
soups, hot soups,
Yoo-hoo
sandwiches if you need them. I'm thinking of Panera Bread again, aren't I? I get Maximum Fun and Panera Bread mixed up a lot.
I know. Well, they're both, you know, wonderful.
They're both warm and toasty. I think. I don't know anything about Panera Bread. They may have their guy.
That started in St. Louis, by the way.
Oh, did it?
In St. Louis, it's still called St. Louis Bread Company because that's how it started.
I remember being very confused by that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think that's it. We have stuff at macroy.family. You can send in your submissions at wonderfulpodcast@gmail.com. And yeah, I think that's about it. Let's round her up.
Yeehaw.
That's the little, oh my God, it's the littlest cowboy ever. Get over here, littlest cowboy ever.
Howdy, y'all.
Hey, does your little horse need some little water?
Well, he might like it.
Okay. I wonder if this bit's going to go anywhere. What do you think, little cowboy?
Nope.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.
If you're looking for a new comedy podcast, why not try the Beef and Dairy Network? It won Best Comedy at the British Podcast Awards in 2017 and 2018. Also, ILO.
There were no horses in this country until the mid to late 60s.
Specialist bovine arse vet.
Both of his eyes are squid's eyes.
Yogurt buffet.
She was married to a bacon farmer who saved her life.
Farm-raised snow leopard.
Download it today. That's the Beef and Dairy Network podcast from MaximumFun.org. Also, maybe start at episode 1, or weirdly, episode 36, which for some reason requires no knowledge of the rest of the show.